following program was produced by Clock Tower Radio, clocktower.org, and is broadcast in partnership with Wave Farms WGXC 90.7 FM.
This is Charles Ruas welcoming you to a program from my audio archives from the 1970s. As Director of Arts Programming at WBAI-FM, the Pacifica radio station in New York City, I produced programs that covered all the contemporary arts, including drama, literature, and experimental radio programs as well.
With the cooperation of Clock Tower, these programs have been restored for broadcast on Clock Tower Radio, operating at clocktower.org. In this edition, you will hear novelist Craig Nova reading from his book, The Geek.
The Geek. Charles Ruas interviews Craig Nova, author of the recently published Harper and Row novel, The Geek.
This is Charles Ruas interviewing Craig Nova, whose second novel, The Geek, has just been published. Craig, you'll have to tell our listeners the definition of the word The Geek.
A geek is the carnival character who is an alcoholic and who performs for a drink. Usually he will bite the head off a chicken or a snake or something like that. A geek is the picture of humiliation. It's the rock bottom.
But it's self-imposed, the
yes,
chosen.
Absolutely. Geeks become geeks by what they've done throughout their lives, usually a long-term process, which will lead to being a geek. Alcoholism definitely is a large part of it.
Craig, what are the implications when an individual chooses to amuse others by his self-humiliation or by performing tricks and acts which will degrade himself?
I'm not so sure that he really is providing any enjoyment, as I point out in the book. He's more outrageous than he is anything else. And I think it's a matter of hostility, just blind hostility more than anything else. Have you ever seen a geek yourself?
Absolutely not. I've known many, though.
Yeah, well,
but I don't watch them.
I saw one in Greece, and it seemed to me that the people who were watching him were more outraged than amused. It seems as though the geek was parodying their own lives, their own humiliation, what they had to go through to even living out of very, very poor land. And it was that outrage that attracted, both attracted and repelled. There was something very strange in the air. Hostility, violence, humiliation. It was a very, very odd, very, very odd atmosphere.
Is the geek a particularly Greek or European character versus the freak show, for example, or sideshows in this country?
I've only heard of them working in four parts of the world, South America, the Caribbean, in this country, in Greece, and in Europe.
Which makes them universal.
Which suddenly occurred to me, I guess, that that makes them pretty much omnipresent. But to see one is a very unsettling sight. And I did see one, and that's why I ended up writing this book, because I was very curious about what could possibly go into making a geek. And that, of course, is the essence of the book, the history, or the immediate history before man turns into a geek.
You entitled the novel The Geek rather than using the name of the protagonist, Boot. Was there a special reason why the idea of this character should dominate the whole text?
Well, for one reason, a very technical reason, which is that I wanted the reader to be aware that there is something horrific surrounding the island, which is a geek, or an atmosphere graced or touched by what a geek is. And I did want that in the reader's mind. And also, I think that it's a little tacky to surprise a reader with an ending like the ending of this book, where it does seem to come out of the blue a little bit. So I did want the reader to be thinking about a geek all the way through. And then the ending, of course, is much more understandable if they've been looking towards or looking for those things that might go into making someone a geek, as a geek. And also I have this drawing for the cover, which I wanted to use very much. So
I was astounded. Your novel is published in a beautiful format, but it's one of the first illustrated novels I've run across since my reading of 19th century texts.
The Mark Twain editions of Huckleberry Finn.
Or Anthony Trollope's little charming characters.
Well, the way that happened was that Brad Holland did the dust jacket for my first book, and after that was published, we had a drink one night, and he said, look, I'd like to take a look at your second book, and if I like it, I'd like to do some drawings for it. And I gave him the manuscript, and he said, sure, I'd love to. And the book is produced so nicely, basically because Brad Holland does know about the production of drawings. You know, it's about paper. Those are the kinds of things that the publishers keep writers ignorant of, because knowledge is power. And if you know something about the way books are produced, well, then you can ask for things that they don't want you to ask for. Say, good paper, good binding, a good jacket.
This is one of the most handsome volumes I've seen in recent times. But to get back into the novel, The Geek takes place on an island, and of course the basic issue on the island is the growing of opium. And there seems to me in my mind an association between, of course, the opium and opiate and the whole idea of transformation into a geek, since one is dream producing.
I think that the basic connection is one between the geek as an escape from the demands of making a living on an island as barren as, say, Samos, where the book is set. That kind of escape is schematically perhaps the same as smoking opium, which is also an escape from daily, incredible grind just to make a living, just to get something to eat. And there are many people who do smoke opium. In this case, I think that it's because Samos is so close to the Turkish coast, I think that there is some cultural crossplay whereby Greeks, who by and large despise Turks, but I think that they have picked up one bad habit, which is smoking opium.
You say explicitly that on this impoverished island with its barren soil, the fields, the land itself, is too precious to be turned over to poppy growing. And yet opium, when it's used, is such a precious and, of course, profitable a product. So that the mores of the islanders are stronger than the habit they've acquired.
Well, it's very strange that something as precious as the land would be used to produce something that would allow people to escape from the land that they have to work every day to eat. It's an irony that that occurs to me now. I didn't intend it when I was writing it, but I like it.
No, the irony is that were they to grow opium, it would be a prosperous little island very quickly.
No, of course, they refused. I mean, no, I meant that the irony was that the land would give them relief through opium rather than this dreadful day-by-day nightmare of working. I've never seen people work harder in my life, in any place in the world, to make a living than on Samos.
And yet the name of your protagonist is Boot. Is that significant also?
No. That's a personal thing. I have a difficulty with names. For some reason or other, every time I pick up a book and it says Charles Samuelson opened his door on February 13th, 1924, it seems as though given Christian names have been abused by writers so much that I don't believe them anymore. When any writer says whatever, Bob, Joe, Pete,
Anna whoever, stepped off the train in a pearl gray dress.
I could see the writer straining right there.
But why Boot? I mean, it's not only an apparel, but it refers to a limb.
That's definitely was part of it. And also, I did want a name that had, if not American, definitely an Anglo-Saxon tone to it, to set him off from the rest of the characters who all have very Greek names. And I did want something that that would be definitely non-Greek. And that definitely is a non-Greek name. Actually, it is his last name. I mean, the whole name is Charles Boot. But I just do not mention the word Charles. I think it's mentioned once. But
mm-hmm. As you know, being called Charles, I'm biased. but Craig, Boot remains essentially the outsider. And to that extent, of course, the question comes up, even though it blurs the difference between protagonist and the author, I'm wondering to what extent it reflects your view of Samos.
Well, actually, that brings up a very interesting problem. I think it's one that the readers have a great deal of difficulty with, which is although any piece of fiction is dressed up in the trappings of everyday life, it really has nothing to do with it. Those trappings are just as false as the papier-mâché sets used in Hollywood, and they are only sets. For some reason, when someone reads a book, they tend to think that it did happen more than they would think that something had happened if they had gone to a movie. Well, the book, I think there's a vision behind the book which I believe in. I would hate to paraphrase that that vision. I think that is the book. There is one thing I did want to say, which is that it does seem to me that that there is a dead end to traditional psychological fiction. Everyone on the island has a history, except for him. We only know his character by his actions. He's not really explained. We just watch him at work. So it seems to me that the event is of primary importance. I think that the minute a writer begins to explain something that's happened, he's failed already. Because if a reader can't understand for himself or herself what is going on and why without being told, then the writer has made some dreadful error.
So that the traditional psychological novel, explaining motives, decisions, actions, for you,
is
historically dated?
Not historically dated, I think generally false.
But you wouldn't dismiss, I mean, the great body of brilliant psychological novels in our literature.
No, I certainly wouldn't dismiss Dostoevsky or Tolstoy or any of the Russians. I guess what I'm really trying to say is that it's been used so much, and psychology has become such an overwhelming part of our daily life that it seems to have lost its validity as far as writing novels is concerned. And also, I'd like to make the point that no one really needs to explain why Oedipus is so obsessed with solving a murder. It does set off some resonance someplace where the event and the reason for it are one and the same. Well, there is a welding of the two. It's that I'm trying to find, which is to say, and at the risk of sounding overwhelmingly pretentious, that I am trying to write a sort of myth, which does, by its very nature, explain certain things.
But just as you've complained that psychology has fallen into such common parlance that it no longer really explains, so that many people use psychology not as insights into whatever is occurring, but simply as a cliche to sort of cover over events. Hasn't that also occurred with myths, in the sense that in our culture today, that you have a hard time distinguishing between myth in its ceremonial religious sense and comic book or cartoon sense?
When I say myth, I should say a specific variety, perhaps the myth of one human being, one character, that is explained by the way it is presented. Period. It's sad that so many words are abused to the point of no longer meaning anything, and words like myth can mean almost everything, and because of that, they mean almost nothing. What I mean by myth is something different from what you might think it could mean.
As I understand your definition, then, by individual myth, you mean a person who is defined by his story as Perseus, etc., which leads us into the second fallacy of the hero.
I would not want to go any further than saying that he is explained by his story, which is the perfect paraphrase. So the author never has to intrude and say, this character is doing whatever he is doing because 16 years before he saw it's that kind of thing that I'm trying to avoid altogether. I think that there certainly must be connections between events in anyone's life. I mean, there are certain events that have had effects on people, and I do believe that they're there. But I'd rather bring them out by intuition and by a very oblique approach than coming down very hard. Mm-hmm. There's one other thing that operates in the book, which does have to do with character, which is what we're basically speaking about anyway, is that at one point Henry James wrote in his notebook that landscape is character. That's why I do dwell on the landscape in this book as much as I do, because I do think it is an oblique way of getting to the people who are on the island and what they're doing. When something is described, when an object is described, I'm trying to come close to the people, but from a very, very oblique angle. Someone once said that a novel is like a paranoid personality, in that everything is important if you're dealing with certain concepts, ideas, whatever, the way things are described will be described with the connotations appropriate to those concepts and those ideas.
But what James, I think James was quoting Flaubert when he said that, but I want very much to ask you then, if the island of Samos reflects so much of the vision and personality of Booth, the protagonist of the novel, then the natural question is, if there's no psychological explanation and you find that historically dated, is there cause and effect in the construction of the novel?
Yes.
Obviously we're eliminating character as causality here.
There is certainly cause and effect in the events that occur in the book.
Occur to him.
And that the things that he does to other people, which in turn cause things to be sprung on him also. It's a very difficult thing to explain. It's as though there were a piece of land and somebody managed to take a personality and put it in a huge oil drum with a spray gun attached, and they sprayed this landscape with that personality. This is an imaginative, ridiculous conceit, but it is close to what I'm trying to do. So that landscape is the character.
When Boot teams up with the girl he meets at the beginning of the novel, they do form a relationship, which is clearly delineated in the book. And yet, would you use the word love to apply?
No, the word love is never mentioned. I mean, it's the island is much too stark for a word as gentle as the word love, and the relationship is much too stark for the word love. No, it has to do with one of the basic concerns of the book, which is the nature of struggle, and I'm absolutely convinced that there is a connection between sexuality and struggle. You notice that he fails ultimately when the object, when the vessel of his sexuality is withdrawn from him. Complete and total failure. That's when he's done. That's when he gives up. Boot has been struggling against a number of the islanders, making deals, exchanging insults, and she's always with him. And there is a sexual bond between them that I think gives him the extra push to continue. And when she leaves him, he's been shorn of something. And there is some mystery there, but I don't want to tamper with too deeply or too bluntly. I do think that a good book defines a mystery to a certain extent. And there is a mystery defined by the events of the last part of the book that I want to just hint at and leave it for the reader to decide for himself or herself what that mystery is. As when you pick up a book, say, about The Great Gatsby, I mean, basically it's a mystery, which is never solved. I mean, who is Gatsby? What is he? Where does he come from? What is he really? Those are questions that readers ask again and again and again. If they like The Great Gatsby, of course. I mean.
The second question I wanted to ask you about is, again, related to not so much to the concept of love, but to the concept of escape, and that is the opium smugglers and the function of the smuggler on such an island. Was that abstract?
No, not really. His function, of course, is to provide escape, and it's very strange. You could draw a rough parallel between what Boot is to Mara, is what the islanders are to the island. The opium smuggler is to the relationship between Boot and Mara, what the geek is to the relationship between the islanders and the island. The escape, the release from the pressures of both systems. Because they're both aliens. The geek and the opium smuggler are really aliens of some variety.
As is Boot.
Yes, definitely. And he does end up a geek too, also. I mean, it's part of one of the things that bringing along throughout the book, but he definitely is an alien. He's an American with no past on a Greek island.
But, of course, the paradox is this extraordinary sequence of event occurs on an island, and an island is a place without exit, without escape, whether it's through the geek or through the tourism or through opium. One never leaves an island.
That's to be one of the things that I was concerned with was a sense of claustrophobia, which is why it is set on an island. It could have been set on the Greek mainland very easily, but I did want that sense of claustrophobia. That's why in the language itself there are words that are repeated 4 or 5 times to give even a literary sense of claustrophobia. So when you're reading the book, you kinesthetically, I mean bodily, you feel that claustrophobia that I did feel on the island. And it's something that I did want to bring into the book.
Then to return to your idea of eros or sexuality and struggle, that is, the self as a continuous struggle, then it seems to me that inevitably one comes to a pessimistic vision that the struggle is ceaseless, whether as an outsider or as a geek.
That's true. The struggle is ceaseless, but there is one line from the very end of the book, which I would like to read, which does bring those two considerations together. The final scene of the book is a carnival, and Boot shows up at the carnival and sees some people dancing. There was a singer, too, and the words and the music and the dance had the tone of both unexplained loss and gladly accepted joy, a spirit that could absorb and was tinted by vanished boats, unrecovered bodies, matches made. No one could say the emotion was pleasant or painful, The atmosphere was graced by a buzzing and gut-sinking quality, an orgasmic knowledge of the mixture of success and failure. So the two are mixed together throughout the book, both failing and succeeding. And that is really the point of the book, is the two are mixed together. It's impossible to ever succeed totally or fail totally.
Within the circumference of experience.
Certainly within the circumference of this book and these characters. I'm not making any general comments about New York City, Big Mac, God knows what. No, it's only the confines of this book and this island and these characters.
You've been listening to Charles Ruas interviewing novelist Craig Nova, author of The Geek. We'll now hear Mr. Nova reading from The Geek.
The Geek was short and gave the impression of being deformed, although in fact he was not. But he had the thinness of a terminal alcoholic, and he trembled. The Geek kneeled. His trembling was not exaggerated or spasmodic. It seemed to be evidence of a gentle humming that ran throughout his body. He was dirty, or more than dirty, as though the crusted circles on his face and arms were produced rather than acquired. His hair and beard were thin and greasy, and there were bugs crawling on his scalp and along with seborrheic patches on his face. One ear was cauliflowered, and his nose looked like it had been broken more than once and by something more than flesh and bone, iron or a piece of pipe. His eyes were soft and mild and reassuring. It was though he gazed not from a state of mind, such as peacefulness or serenity, but from stone or sunlight, gold or ice. Boot found the girl on the beach, hair and one arm animated by slight waves, her water-soaked dress ripped enough to expose adolescent breasts, an untried stomach, perfectly formed limbs. There was a neat line of holes that ran diagonally across her side and lower stomach. Each perforation was surrounded by darkened flesh. A sand crab, its movements abrupt and mechanical, crawled slowly between the girl's legs, toward furrowed flesh, a slightly flaring ridge of hair. There was a disease on the mainland so similar to plague as to inspire the same fear, and at night there were those who tried to flee to the island, risking the patrol boats that worked in the channel between dusk and dawn. From the sea, the island looked brownish and rocky, projecting in startled relief above blue water, the mountain ridges appearing serpentine, as though the island were some buoyant lizard, both fantastic and forbidding. There was a leper colony at one end, but the lepers were confined to their grounds and were rarely seen in the streets of the village, although every now and then children clowned, pulled hands into stumpy claws. The patrol boats were armed with machine guns. The fisherman said, "What?" Boot stood in the door of the fisherman's lean-to. The fisherman held a glass of ouzo. The fisherman was called Petros, and he lived alone. All the fishermen on the island were superstitious, but Petros was more so than others. He took his boat at night and watched the stars, listened as the fish filled the nets. His beliefs were a dam against terror, since there were times when he acted in a manner that confused and frightened him. Some islanders argued that the boils caused the episodes of generic idiocy. Some said it was the ironing. Because when Petrus was 4, his scalp flowered, bloomed with sores that itched and were crusted, and oozed a yellowish substance. Petrus' father, a fisherman who was almost as superstitious as a man his son became, went each day to the monastery and prayed and lit candles before the icons, but the sores continued to ooze. So, after 2 weeks, he rowed, which shows that the islanders' lives had improved some in 50 years, because now Petrus had an inboard engine, to the other side of the island, taking with him his wife and Petros to see the sorceress, who looked at the head and scraped off some of the crust and put it in a sack for safekeeping and advised the use of poultice and heat. Petros' father gave her a coin, rode back to the lean-to, made the poultice and waited, and the sores grew worse. Petros' father said to his wife, "Bring the iron." The wife brought the iron, one that had a lid and required coals for heat, and his father put in the coals, and the mother held Petros and covered his head with a cloth, and his father ironed the boils and waited again,
and this time, whether the disease had run its natural course or because the heat had dried up the sources of infection, the boils disappeared. But soon, Petros' father was back at the monastery and back to see the sorceress as well, because Petros acted like an idiot. And when Petros became an adolescent, he masturbated so much that his father bound Petros' hands with tape. Petros' father went back to the sorceress, who made a tea from the crusts of the original sores. Petros drank the tea, but it did no good, certainly less good than the tape, which worked except for those times Petros was alone with his younger sister, who had the compassion to remove the tape and leave him alone in the bushes. Boot heard the arguments in tavernas. There is no need, because if you have parents stupid enough to iron your head, the chances of getting a full deck are pretty slim anyway. But time helped. When his father died, Petros was more than capable of looking after himself. The stupidity had been relegated to periodic fits, seasonal ravings. And when these episodes were barely noticeable, or when they had been accepted by the islanders as part of their own heritage, Petros married a woman who was 20 years older, ugly and old and with a small dowry, because Petros was a poor fisherman who lived in a lean-to and who had a reputation for stupidity. Everyone was ashamed at the wedding, but shame didn't keep guests from getting drunk on the liquor of the bride's parents, nor did it keep them from making jokes about the match that could be heard by everyone. The bride's dowry was just enough to pay for the inboard engine, but on the night of the wedding, the engine hadn't been bought, so Petros' bride had to put the shamed, stumbling Petros into his boat, the same one that his father had used, and row him to the lean-to, and then coax him from the boat into bed. The wife lived for 15 years. She died so quietly that Petros slept next to the corpse for 8 hours before taking notice of her death, and then spent the next 10 years alone, fishing, drinking in a taverna, always sleeping on his side of the bed, becoming surprised at how much his mind cleared as the years passed. And although his superstition and religion were stronger than his father's, when Petros was 50 years old, about the time Boot came to live in a house near the lean-to, he had developed a certain slyness. "Bring your boat," said Boot. "It's bad luck to carry a body in a boat," said Petros. Boot waited on the beach, flicking away with a piece of bamboo that had been growing near the shore, the sand fleas and crabs that hopped and crawled around the girl. The half-foot waves broke with the same insistence as an unfastened shutter beating against the side of a house in a strong wind. Petros stood in the center of the boat, using the oars like stilts. The inboard was always saved for longer trips. "What are you doing?" said Petros. Boot held the bamboo as though it were a fishing pole. The girl lay beneath the pointed leaves. "Nothing," said Boot, throwing the pole into the water. Petros beached his boat and stared at the girl. "Give me a piece of cloth," said Boot, pointing to one of the burlap sacks that Petros used to carry his catch from the boat to the fishmonger's. "There's no hurry," said Petros. Boot took a piece of cloth and covered the girl. "I won't take it," said Petros. Boot dug in his pockets for money. "No," said Petros. "It's bad luck to carry a body in a boat. I won't do it." "All right," said Boot. "I'll keep the sack." Boot's house was at the base of one ridge that formed with another a small valley, about 100 yards long and 150 yards wide. In addition to Boot's house, there were 4 other structures: a farmer's house, a taverna that was open 2 days a week, a church that was maintained by Petros and had been maintained by Petros' father before him, and Petros' lean-to. Sometimes fishermen who were caught in bad weather spent the night in the church, a small, round building covered with plaster, topped with a dome and a cross. There were fields, small rectangular plots that ran from Boot's house down to the beach, banked there by a stone wall. Some of the smallest plots were planted with tomatoes and squash, but the largest and best pieces of land were planted with grapes. At least there was a little money in wine. After a while, when the land has cut up some more, one man, finally, will have just enough to bury himself in 1 6-by-9 patch planted with vines and squash, but fishermen have it easier. He still held the note over the girl. "No one divides up the ocean for a daughter's dowry. A fisherman can throw himself in anywhere and call it good." 2 farmers worked in the fields, a man and a woman, both old and almost indistinguishable from each other because they were of the same size, height, and weight, and they held their clothes in common, sometimes picking up in the morning what the other had discarded the night before. They lived in a house that was on the same ridge as Boots, but it was a little further up, connected to the fields by switchbacks cut into rock. They worked the land with short-handled hoes, stooping over the vines. From a distance, each looked like some man-sized growth, on which someone had put a straw hat, a hat that would serve better in compost than on someone's head, the hose chopped into black mounds as the farmers directed water into one row at a time. But the land was farmed scientifically, or could have been farmed scientifically, if there had been money to follow modern advice. Twice a year, a man came from the Department of Agriculture to look at the fields and to talk about poisons and fertilizers, and since he was a lecher of almost legendary, and therefore almost acceptable, proportions, to inspect the island's crop of dodders as well, his remarks concerning which were almost as important as those concerning the squash or vines or irrigation systems. He didn't come as often as he used to, since the farmers were long past the age of bearing children. There was nothing the farmers could do about scorpions. They were drawn to water. "I need to borrow your jackass," said Boot. "He won't take her," said Eula, looking up, squinting into the morning sun. "Is it bad luck to carry a body on a jackass?" said Boot. "It's bad on a boat," said the man, who didn't bother to look up or break stride, still using his hoe in an old and easy motion. The woman began to use her hoe again, striking in counterpoint to her husband. Boot knew that as soon as he was over the ridge, the woman would be in the harness of the boom where the jackass was now, turning around the well to bring up water. "And the pack saddle," said Boot. "It's in front of the house," said the man, "in the shade." The scorpion, jointed, green, shiny, came from under the leaf of the squash vines. "Give me the razor," said the farmer. His wife took the razor from her apron, and the farmer slashed the rising sting and sucked blood. Boot stepped on the scorpion, feeling the tender shell crack beneath his heel. The farmer spit onto the green leaves. "If you keep him overnight," said the farmer, "you've got to feed him." That would be 2 days she'd have to turn the boom. Boot unharnessed the jackass and cinched up the saddle. The cinch was homemade, braided from bits and pieces of worn rope. On the beach, Boot lifted the girl, smelled the salt and seaweed, and turned toward the jackass, trying not to touch the girl's flesh, holding her by the dress alone. Flies buzzed on the beach. The dress ripped, and the girl fell onto the pebbles again, now completely naked, sprawled, obscene. Boot took his pocket knife and slit the burlap sack near the bottom. He didn't want to make an opening for the head, but he was afraid the sack wouldn't cover the girl unless he did. He propped her up and dressed her in burlap, working it under the buttocks and over her thighs, covering the exposed groin. The jackass stood quietly, watching Boot with a blunt indifference. Boot put the girl sideways between the two X-shaped saddle trees, then carefully tucked her hair into the ragged collar and covered her head with the water-soaked dress. "Here," said Eula, the farmer, holding a piece of rope. She stood on the stone wall at the end of her field. "You'll need this." Boot wrapped the rope over the girl and under the trees. He cut a piece from one end and tied the girl's legs together at the ankles. She lay face down on the jackass. "He won't take her," said Boot. "So," said the woman. "Maybe I'll only take her as far as the monastery," said Boot. The monastery was halfway to town. The jackass knew the way because the woman's son, who lived in town, used the animal to pack in warm beer and ouzo for the taverna he kept open 2 days a week. It was a place where fishermen came, or perhaps some villagers on an outing, but whether they were fishermen or villagers, they usually came by boat. The island had been shelled heavily during the war, and every now and then someone was killed by stepping on an unexploded shell. The road was safe enough, but it was a half mile from Boot's house to the road. The girl amplified the movement of a jackass as it picked its way among the stones. Small, quick lizards, the color of artichokes, raced among the rocks as Boot followed the jackass to the top of the ridge. "I didn't bring water." He looked at the bay, the land around it shaped like two fingers about to pick up a pin. The water was so clear that Boot could see the stones on the bottom, the submarine vegetation covering them. The jackass's hooves clicked on the stones that lay in the path, which was bordered on both sides by desert-like plants. The dirt road appeared to Boot as the whitest excoriation in the side of the hills that dropped to the sea. The road began just beyond the opium smuggler's yard, on both sides of which there were low buildings that looked more like animal sheds than places where people lived, huts that seemed to grow from the ground itself, since they were constructed of the stones that covered the landscape. The opium smuggler slept in the road, or at that point where his yard turned into the road. He slept in the morning sunlight, using his dog for a pillow. The opium smuggler had black hair and a graying beard, a reddish face, a posture that was at ease anywhere, a mercenary eye. He had a reputation for getting what he wanted. It was founded on dealing so delicate and so crude that no one on the island really knew how he went about succeeding, since most islanders, held success, any kind at all, in awesome appreciation, the opium smuggler's dealings had become part of the islander's mythology. He terrified most people. When the engineers had come with bulldozers to extend the road from the monastery to the cove where Boot lived, the opium smuggler erected a barricade and stood in the sunlight, swilling liquor and holding a breech-loading rifle that his father had wielded in fantasies of defending the island against hordes of invading Turks. The opium smuggler swore that any man who touched a machine would be feeding vultures before dark. The rotting carcass would be a monument to the foolishness of trying to build a road through his yard. He swore in a manner so blasphemous that grown men were frightened by it. The engineers asked permission to return to town. The opium smuggler swore whenever he came from his house and saw that the road entered the outer part of his yard. If people want to buy opium, said the opium smuggler, they don't need roads. The house Boot rented was available because of the opium smuggler, since no one wanted to pass him or his yard or house on the way to town. Boot and the opium smuggler get along well, though. Boot never came around after dark, liked to smoke a little opium now and then, liked to drink, and liked to listen to stories. And he had enough sense not to ask any questions, aside from those about the language, which the opium smuggler answered freely, giving obscene examples. It didn't bother the opium smuggler that Boot was a foreigner, since the opium smuggler himself was something of an alien on his own island. He had no friends, only business connections. There were stories told on the island of a disappearance of young women, of screams and cries coming from one of the low buildings near the opium smuggler's house, of hurried pre-dawn crossings in a small boat to the mainland. The opium smuggler was asleep in the road because he was drunk, and he was drunk because business was bad. The disease made it doubly difficult to make the channel crossing, whether just for opium or as a private trading route, young women one way, opium the other. After 6 months, after watching Boot carefully, the opium smuggler said, "You know, my life would be a lot easier if I could find someone to grow it on the island." He said it and stared at Boot, and Boot nodded. "You understand?" said the opium smuggler. "Yes," said Boot. Because that was the one thing the opium smuggler had never been able to arrange. The land was too valuable, not in dollars, but in generations of toil and frustration. It was the emblem of marriage as well, since for centuries a piece of land had been the basis of any respectable dowry. It was too personal a substance to defile by the growth of opium, so the opium smuggler continued to make the crossings of the channel, knowing that even if he found someone who would be willing to grow it on the island, the crop would have to be cultivated in secrecy, for fear other farmers would come to burn the fields. The jackass scattered chickens like the bow of a boat, spreading waves. Boot squatted next to the opium smuggler and waited for him to open an eye. The dog wagged its tail, then ran to the jackass and began to sniff. Boot threw a stone, and the dog howled and ran toward one of the buildings that looked like a hen house. "What's on the jackass?" said the opium smuggler. "I need water," said Boot. "I'm going to town." The opium smuggler looked at the well-formed limbs and thick hair with an appraiser's eye. He knocked pale dust from the American T-shirt that Boot had given him. "You can see what's on the jackass," said Boot. Boot took the bottle that was lying next to the opium smuggler and drank twice, swallowing quickly. "It would be all right to drink my liquor," said the opium smuggler, "if you bought opium, but you don't buy opium anymore." Boot shrugged and pulled on the bottle, feeling his stomach quake, tasting a licorice-tinted vomit as it climbed in his throat. "You haven't got any," said Boot, gesturing with the bottle toward the mainland. "Disease." "I'll get the water," said the opium smuggler. He staggered once, as though it were possible to bump into a hangover. There were bored, or previously bored, withdrawal kept them occupied, men who sat in the tavernas, too old or arthritic to work, bent as though years were heavy, men who now had running noses and whose moist eyes were set on the straight. They were short 2 daily pipes and getting jumpy. It wasn't regret for those in the mainland that set their skittish expressions. From a 5-gallon can with the top cut off, the opium smuggler poured cool water from the well over the girl. The jackass was terrified and confused. The load didn't give, and no one had poured water on the animal before. "Have fun drinking out of it," said the opium smuggler. "It's all I've got." The opium smuggler poured the last of the water into a small can, one that also had a lip like a saw blade, and handed it to Boot. Water dripped from the girl's legs and arms and from a jackass's furry belly onto the road, turning the dust on the stones into thin mud. "I need a hat," said Boot. He felt the sun on his head with an intensity equal to the sensation of a liquor in his stomach. A blob moved slowly at the top of his constricted shadow. The opium smuggler took the bottle and wiped the lip with the end of the T-shirt. "You can never be too careful," said Boot. if you know so much about it, said the opium smuggler. Why are you leading this jackass around? Here. He took from his back pocket a straw hat, one that had been folded twice, and put it over Boots' head. The slowly moving blob became sharp and pointed. You could put some in a jug, said Boot. What? Said the opium smuggler. Boot watched the pointed shadow slide over the stones. The opium smuggler was gone, or left behind, sitting at the beginning of the road, under a tree now, where there was a little shade. Boot watched the shadow, not wanting to look over his shoulder at what followed on the jackass, not wanting to look ahead, because there were only the hills and a scratch in them, the road that appeared to be paved with bones. The sea seemed to be covered by a clear membrane, touched with abrasions here and there by the wind. There were hook-shaped lines attached to a fisherman's nets, and the streaks that reminded Boot of the minute stretch marks women have on their breasts and hips. The jackass grazed the side of the road, pulling at the rough growth there. Boot grabbed the halter. He drank from the can, spit on white stones, stained them with watery blood. He could have put some in a jug. I didn't want the whole bottle. Boot watched his shadow run down to rocks that looked newly formed, as though they had slipped that day in a molten state from the hills to the sea. The water bubbled and turned white around them, making the rocks seem not only rigid, but hot as well. Boot thought again and grabbed the halter and followed his shadow up the road. Maybe he believes that only a foreigner could be brutal enough to make it possible to grow opium on the island. Maybe that's why he wants me to arrange it. On the left, above the road, there were terraced, almost oriental fields, each growing a large crop of weeds. The monastery was on the right side of the road, built on the top of stone that dropped as straight as curtains to the sea. It was surrounded by a wall 2 stories high and 6 feet thick. The monks' cells were on the inside of the wall, and they were connected by a veranda. The cells had only one window and one door, and these faced the church. There was nothing else for the monks to look at. There was a terrace, too, covered with flagstone, in the center of which was a large tree. Its exposed roots gripped a thin layer of soil. The terrace served as the monastery's taverna, and it had a view of the strait and the mainland. The monastery was cool and damp. Moss grew on the walls. There were other buildings as well, but they were no longer in use. Storerooms, small additions to the main wall in which, years before, monks had labored over looms and made candles and shoes and habits. The storerooms had been stocked against plague time, those periods when for years the monastery would be totally self-sufficient, as isolated from the rest of the island as a colony of lepers. But there weren't many monks left, only 4 now, and they depended upon the central church for support. But the amount dwindled each year, and the mainstay of the monastery had become the profits from its taverna. Boot left the jackass in the yard, beneath a tree outside the gates, and walked to the terrace, where there were tables and chairs. He took a seat close to a retaining wall that marked the abrupt end of a stone on which the monastery was built. Below, at the bottom of the cliff, there were the remains of a medieval dock, constructed of stone and patched with cement, and still in use, both as a dock and as a platform for sunbathers. There was a woman there now, alone, nude, sunning herself and diving every now and then into the cool water. A foreigner, said Lucas, the monk, the one who had been elected to wait on tables. The monk had lost at cards. She swam gracefully, leaving behind a milky wake. Drink, said Boot. Lucas's face was set deeply in his habit, but Boot could see the pale eyes, white and patchy beard, shocked brows, fish-belly skin. Do you have any money today? Said Lucas. Boot showed a banknote, a piece of paper covered with rust-colored ink, the same bill he had held over the girl. The day before, the opium smuggler had changed, for Boot, at a rate slightly higher than the bank's, $100 into local currency. It was the last of Boot's cash, although there was still a little money, but he had been on Samos for a year, and the tens and twenties looked ridiculous. The opium smuggler needed dollars. "I'll bring beer," said Lucas. "It's too early for Uzo." "Bring beer," said Boot, "and Uzo too." Boot looked at the low doorways of the monastery. The people were short, subsisting on olives, onions, oil, and bread. The island was small, and it demanded of those who lived there proportional size. There are limitations, in any case, on the engineering of flesh and bone, because a man could grow, at most, to 27 feet. Beyond that, the body would collapse. Bones would bend and snap. Flesh would sag. The whole mess would sink into a sanguine puddle. "You have blood on your lips and chin," said Lucas. Boot listened to the sound of hard soles on the ancient stone as he walked around the church, under the hibiscus and stunted pine, drinking from the bottle, wincing when he came into a patch of sunlight. "The monastery burned down once," said Lucas, still sitting at the table, his voice filling the courtyard. In the church, Boot smelled the musk of centuries, the residue of a million sticks of incense. The icons were covered with gold, and they hung on walls in which Boot could see pieces of pagan temples, columns that were used log cabin style, one cemented on top of another. Nothing was ever wasted. Churches were built on the old sites, were resonant with human sacrifice, libations. Ancient columns supported the domed ceiling, too. Petros was kneeling beneath the nave, swaying in a holy tick. Boot sat in one of the wooden chairs that were built against three walls of a church, and drank and listened to the mumbling. Petros finished, lit a brownish, crude candle, and walked from icon to icon. His lips made a smacking sound as they touched each one. "I have it on a jackass," said Boot. Petros glanced at him once, but he didn't break stride between the icons. "God damn, son." The door of a church swung slowly on its hinges. "God damn." The light was so clear, so intense, it seemed as unchangeable as a stone. "The monastery was very rich then," said the monk, "centuries ago. People came from hundreds of kilometers to bring silver and gold for icons." Boot looked over the wall. She was dressing now, cheerfully wiggling into her clothes. He stood on a shadow, fixed there, struck by a tremor so strong his body felt like iron, stood there and watched hair twirl in sunlight, the natural and unassuming grace with which she bent over a sandal. "Very rich," said Lucas, "and when it burned, the silver and the gold melted and ran toward the ocean, and farmers came for years with rope and hung over the cliff, looking for congealed bits." "Who is she?" said Boot. "A foreigner," said Lucas, with scopsic indifference. "Look what drink does to you." "It's not drink," said Boot. "You don't have to get angry," said Lucas. "I'm not angry." The monk's face was swallowed by the habit. Boot drank from the bottle. The woman wore a pair of jeans and a blouse and had a scarf around what hair? Boot watched her climb the switchback that led from the ancient quay to the monastery terrace. Noticed that she took an obvious joy in walking, in the shock of working flesh. When she stepped onto the terrace, Boot could smell the sea on her skin. He still wore the opium smuggler's hat, carried the bottle and the can with a ragged lip, had blood on his lower face. "Hello," Boot said in English. "Hello," she said, and walked through the monastery to the gate, carrying over her shoulder in a cheerful manner a bag which held a towel and a brush. Boot was already at the gate, there in time to see her look at the jackass, at what was on it. She gave Boot one horrified glance and began to run up the road. The monk stood at the gate, too, and looked at the jackass tethered in the yard. Boot heard an engine turning over, the harsh sound of grinding gears, tires spinning in gravel. Boot stood with a bottle, astonished, smelling the silty odor that drifted into the flat and shaded place in front of the monastery. "She had a car," said Boot. "A little red one," said Lucas, "with the top down." The monk looked at the jackass, at what was lashed onto it, and said, "It doesn't matter. She wouldn't have taken it anyway." The monk checked the rope that held the girl, retied it with experienced hands, and then brought from the monastery a bucket of water and poured it over the girl. I know that Lucas dreams of virginal thighs, of a hymen tearing with the sound of a ripping sheet, the monk coming gold, as though the sun itself ran from his body, waking to frustration and holy disgust, semen on the cot, a shaking hand before the icon. I understand now. Money isn't simply stuff that changes hands, bits of paper and metal that can be put in a sock or under the mattress or in a cookie jar. Each bill and coin charged by the agony of getting and keeping it is more like electricity, and you've got to be careful about it.
You've been listening to Craig Nova reading from his second novel, The Geek, recently published by Harper & Row. Mr. Nova was interviewed by Charles Ruas. This program was produced by Betsy Chapman, Bob Batter, and Bill Cordham. Technical director was Dave Marks.
This is Charles Ruas. You've been listening to a selection from my historic archives.
With the cooperation of Clock Tower, these programs have been restored for broadcast on Clock Tower Radio, operating at clocktower.org.
The previous program was produced by Clock Tower Radio, clocktower.org, and is broadcast in partnership with Wave Farms WGXC 90.7 FM.